Hi, this is Tom Gelton from NPR. It's my pleasure to fill in for Diane Rehm this week and host this podcast. You may have heard that Diane got married last Saturday to John Hagedorn. It was a lovely wedding. The Washington Post headline was, "At 81, Diane Rehm is once again a blushing bride." She and John are now taking a one-week honeymoon, so congratulations to them both. On my mind this week, the same old turmoil in Washington. There is now a bipartisan bill to help people, at least temporarily, get access to affordable health insurance. President Trump supported the bill at first. Now he has reservations. Also, a painful and seemingly unnecessary blow-up over a president's role in consoling the families of service members killed in the line of duty. And Trump's nominee for the drug czar position, Pennsylvania Congressman Tom Marino. He withdrew his name after a Washington Post 60 Minutes investigation showed he played a key role in weakening the DEA's power to stop the spread of opioids. Lenny Bernstein, the Post reporter who helped break the story, told me how people in the areas most affected by the opioid crisis are reacting to the revelations.
They are furious. They think they've seen the swamp. They have seen the swamp that the president of the United States has promised to drain. And yet, there it is on full display.
And then a conversation with retired Army General Martin Dempsey. He was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under Presidents Bush and Obama. We spoke about his remarkable Twitter feed on leadership. Great leaders, he said in one tweet, are motivated by results, not reviews, accomplishments, not accolades. Was that directed to the White House?
No, I'm not a troll of President Trump's. All I can really do is explain what I've learned over the, you know, many decades of service in what makes a leader effective.
First, Lenny Bernstein of The Washington Post. Well, Lenny, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been working on opioid coverage for about 2 years now.
Correct.
How did you come across this extraordinary story that had sort of missed the attention of so many other people in Washington?
Last year, the national desk of the Washington Post did a project on why people in rural white America were dying at such incredible rates. And the three causes basically were opioids, alcohol, and suicide. And my editor asked me as part of that project to look at why so many pills could get out of the supply chain onto the street. And she said, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me that hundreds of millions of these pills would be able to be diverted to the black market. So how do they get there? So I started reading and I saw that there'd been a lot of coverage of manufacturers and doctors and pharmacists, but not so much about distributors. These are the very, very large companies that take the pills from the manufacturers and bring them to the places where you and I buy them. So I started calling around and asking people, why don't I see anything about their role? Because it seems like it would be critical in the supply chain. And eventually someone said to me, well, you need to speak to Joe Ranazzisi, the DEA guy who has been fighting them for the past decade. And so I called Joe on the phone, and it was one of those lucky moments in reporting where he had been fairly recently pushed out of his job. He was very angry. He had been, you know, talking to so many people who had lost family members to overdoses, and he started telling me about what was going on. And every reporter has had this conversation with the guy who says, you know, they're all corrupt except for me. And, you know, I kind of thought that was what I was getting into until I started checking on his story and everything checked out.
Well, Lenny, let's back up a little bit. Roughly 200,000 people have died from opioid overdoses since 2000, 64,000 last year alone. And what percentage of those people or of opioid addicts more generally got started with prescription painkillers?
The 200,000 number is just prescription pills. That's just prescription overdoses. The 64,000 number, the one that they're estimating for 2016, that's both pills and heroin and now increasingly fentanyl. The 80% of the people addicted to heroin right now started with pills. So that's why keeping the pills off the street is so important. You will prevent the next generation of opioid addicts if you can keep these pills off the street.
And how did those pills get on the street in the first place? I should rather say, how did the pharmaceutical companies all of a sudden begin producing so many pills and distributing them, selling them?
Ironically, the DEA sets the national quota for production of opioids in this country. So the DEA finds itself at both ends of the supply chain. It sets the quota, and then it cleans up the mess at the bottom when all these pills spill out onto the street. So every year, the DEA takes in roughly the number of pills that each company wants to produce, comes up with an aggregate, and then says, okay, we're going to allow this much to be produced. It then starts flowing down the supply chain to places where we buy them, pharmacies, hospices, hospitals. And what happens along the way is that each actor in the supply chain is required by law to report if it sees something untoward. So the distributors who send them to the pharmacies, they are required by law if they get a huge order that doesn't look right. So if your pharmacy is ordering 20,000 pills this month and then 2 months later is ordering 100,000 pills, that's a red flag. The DEA is not going to see that. They don't have the manpower. So the law requires the distributors to flag them. Stop that shipment. Say, this doesn't look right. Can we send somebody out? Because that pharmacy might be selling them to users and dealers.
Was there a moment when the big pharmaceutical companies decided to really emphasize the production and sale of pain-killing drugs? And how did they market that? I mean, what is the background to this big jump in the production of prescription painkillers?
Yes, this is a very important point to the story, and unfortunately it goes back to about 1998-1999. A couple of things came together. Number one, there was a movement in the medical community to address the idea that physicians were not treating pain seriously enough. And so there began to be a rather strong emphasis on treating pain as the fifth vital sign. So that you would not have to live with pain, that it was just too important. We were under-treating pain. At the same time, Purdue Pharma, one of the larger companies, came out with OxyContin, the long-acting version of oxycodone. And they began a marketing blitz that had never been seen before. They went to doctors and they went to pharmacists and they went all over the country and they said, you know what? This stuff's not addictive. And not only that, you don't have to use it just for cancer or end-of-life diseases. You can use this for low back pain. You can use this for knee pain. You can give this to pregnant women who, because of the weight that they're bearing, have problems in their legs. Well, we now know that was not a very good idea because it was highly addictive. And it turns out that for some people whose brains are wired that way, they can become dependent in, you know, a week to 10 days. So those things came together. And there you began to see a dramatic increase in the consumption of opioids. So corresponding to that dramatic increase in the consumption of opioids by legitimate patients, you also began to see a dramatic increase in overdose deaths from people who were getting their hands on them.
You know, the most famous quote in your story is drug dealers in lab coats. Who was providing those people with those drugs?
So there began to be this black market. And doctors and the addicts and the dealers know exactly who they are. A small number of doctors would write you a prescription without examining you. First, this began on the internet, but the DEA stamped that out and the law changed and they were pretty able to crush that. Then the pill mills started to spring up, mostly in South Florida. So you'd go to a doctor and for $300 cash, he wouldn't even examine you. And he would say, okay, here's your prescription, 360 oxy, 120 benzos. Now go down to wherever you want and fill this prescription. Sometimes it was right in the same office. And then everybody knew, all the people who were not using this legitimately, where's that pharmacist who cooperates? And again, usually for cash, $300. I go home with 360 benzo, each of which I can sell for $30 if I don't want to consume them myself. And I'm on my way. And there didn't take a lot of these pharmacies and doctors to start putting millions and millions of pills on the street. Imagine if you write 50 prescriptions in a day for 300 oxy or 360 oxy, that's a lot of pills that get out there just one doctor one day.
And you found some people in the DEA who were aware that this was going on and were determined that the agency do something about it.
Correct. So the Office of Diversion Control, which in those days was essentially seen as a backwater, you know, the glory was going to guys doing heroin and cocaine cases. They realized early on what was going on in the early 2000s. And the first thing they did was crack down on these doctors and pharmacies and pill mills. But there were too many for their manpower. Every time they arrest a guy or put him out of business, another one would pop up. And they use the whack-a-mole analogy, which I think is apt. So they said to themselves, where is the choke point? Where can we stop this? And they realized if they made the distributors follow the law, then these pills couldn't get to the unscrupulous doctors and pharmacists.
What law, what provision in the law?
The Controlled Substances Act of 1970, many, many years ago, it's what now 47 years old, requires that the distributors report to the DEA if they see deliveries, orders, they call them, of large amounts, too frequent amounts, or unusual patterns. So the distributors are required by law to do that. And if they do that, the DEA moves in and takes care of its side of things. And most of them did. Many of them didn't. When they didn't, the DEA would come to them and they'd say, you need to get your act together. You just delivered 100,000 pills to a pharmacy in Kermit, West Virginia, that a town only has 500 people. There's no way. And then again, when they were warned, some people complied, but others didn't. And they did it over and over and over and over again. And finally, the DEA said, we got to move in on these guys.
Which they then did.
And they had two main weapons. One is called an order to show cause. I come to you as a distributor and I say, look, you are violating the law repeatedly. It's egregious. You need to go to an administrative proceeding and show why I shouldn't shut you down. And then the lawyers come in and there's a lot of wrangling and there can take months and months and months. Particularly egregious cases, and I only found 17 of them, although I'm pretty sure there were more, they would walk in after repeated warnings and say to you, you're done. This is an immediate suspension of your controlled substances. We're locking your vault. We're putting up the crime scene tape. And no more controlled substances are leaving this warehouse until we are satisfied that you are going to keep them out of the hands of users and dealers. And by the way, we're going to sanction you for what you did.
Okay, now we get to the intrigue. Now we get to the scandal. What happened next?
The drug companies didn't like this. The drug companies were used to being treated as partners, as colleagues, as equals. Joe Ranazzisi, who had taken over that office in 2006, 2007, he's a cop. He's a guy who comes from the street in Detroit as a DEA agent. He also is a pharmacist. He's also a lawyer. And he said, I'm not going to treat these people as if we are cooperative partners in this chain, because clearly it doesn't work. I am the regulator. They are the regulatees. If they violate the law, I'm going to penalize them. They didn't like this. And they began to push back. Around 2012, 2013, when he went after one of the biggest companies for the second time, Cardinal Health, they said, okay, we got to stop this guy. Those are my words. We have not ever proven that anybody wrote that down on a piece of paper. And so they began a campaign that went in several directions to push back against what Ranazzisi was doing.
And part of this was to weaken the law that you had previously cited.
Right. Let me tell you what they did first. There was a lawyer for the industry, a guy named Lyndon Barber. He had been with Joe Ranazzisi in DEA, and he had helped launch the program to crack down on the distributors.
They were partners.
Joe was the cop. Lyndon was the lawyer. When Lyndon went to the industry, he knew the DEA strategy. He knew the DEA's weaknesses. One of the weaknesses was this idea that the companies, the distributors, were an imminent danger to the public health and safety. Lyndon always felt that that was kind of a vague term and it was a kind of a weak term. So he began to argue, now on behalf of the industry, that the DEA's cases were weak because they were relying on this imminent danger provision in the statute. And he got a pretty good reception in the legal office at DEA. He was a big gun. He was the guy who had started the program. So they listened.
And he's basically warning, hey, the DEA, your case is maybe weaker than you think.
But courts had repeatedly upheld what the DEA was doing. Joe Ranazzisi, an attorney, said, we have no problem with the imminent danger. We are not going to get overturned on this. And a number of lawyers at the DEA said, let's all ignore Lyndon because he works for the industry now. But a number of people didn't, including the head of the legal office who had come in two or three people after Lyndon. So cases began to slow down. Did they say to them, don't make cases? No, of course, they couldn't do that. So they said, well, maybe we need another interview. Maybe we need another expert. Maybe we need to explain to people what a pharmacy is. Maybe we need to explain to people. And guys out in the field, they started to see their cases instead of taking a few months, taking months and months, and in some cases, years. So that was the first thing. Then, as you mentioned, they went to Congress. And they said, we think the imminent danger standard's kind of vague. We think that should be redefined because the companies don't quite understand. What are we supposed to do? What's our role here? The investigators will tell you, you know, please. I mean, if you're dumping several million pills into a small town, you know what you're doing. But up in the halls of Congress, Tom Marino, congressman from Pennsylvania, he took that idea and he crafted some legislation.
Why him?
I'm not sure. Certainly, there was no love lost between Tom Marino and the DEA at that point. He had been hearing from drug companies. He had been hearing from pharmacies that, you know, there's legitimate patients not getting their drugs. But I don't 100% know.
Well, first of all, he lived in a district where there are a lot of opioid addicts. So he certainly was familiar firsthand with the problem.
Yes, that's true. Central Pennsylvania, there are a lot of opioid addicts, and there have been a fair number of overdoses in his home county, in Lycoming County.
And you, but you had also found that he had received some pretty substantial campaign contributions from big pharmaceutical companies.
Yes. When we looked at the 2014 to 2016 period when the law was going through Congress, we found that Marino, Hatch, Marsha Blackburn, the main actors behind this law in both houses, have received a very substantial amount of money from these drug companies. Orrin Hatch has always been a friend of the pharmaceutical industry. That was less surprising than some of the other folks.
Okay, so they succeed in getting a new law passed. What was the key difference between the old law and this new law that you have highlighted?
I'm going to take one step back for you. Marino's version was even more onerous than what finally passed. Marino's version would have made it basically almost a criminal standard that they would have had to show intent to get one of these distributors to lock up their drugs. That was so scary to the DEA and the Justice Department that when it passed the House, Attorney General Eric Holder put out a statement saying, this is a disaster for us. We won't be able to do our job. We won't be able to keep this stuff off the streets if it passes. What finally made it through both houses and was signed by President Obama was a very small change of a few words that took the imminent danger provision and made it into a substantial likelihood of an immediate threat. That raises the bar so high that the DEA virtually cannot use that any longer against distributors, because distributors are up here in the supply chain. They send it down to the pharmacy. It might sit for a week or 2 weeks or 3 days or a month. How are you going to go into a court and convince a judge that they are an immediate threat when they've sent the drugs out a month ago? So it took away the immediate suspension order. And that was the provision that the distributors hated. And that was the provision that the distributors dreaded, because DEA could come in and lock up their drugs without any notice.
And what's been the consequence of that change?
They don't use it anymore. Since 2011, when they issued 65 immediate suspension orders, they are now down to 6 this year. And it's difficult to tell from the records, but it appears that all 6 are against either doctors or pharmacies. We have not found a case against a distributor since November 2015.
Okay, here's what I don't get, Lenny. So the DEA and the Justice Department with Attorney General Holder recognized what was going on in the beginning. They recognized that what was being proposed really threatened their enforcement capability. They probably had some idea that the big pharmaceutical companies were behind this push. Why wasn't their guard up enough for them to see what was coming? Because, you know, the most astounding thing to me in your reporting is that you mentioned President Obama signed this new law. In fact, it passed unanimously. The President Obama's DEA, President Obama's Justice Department went along with it. What happened along the way that their guard dropped?
Several things happened. First of all, Ran Azizi was pushed out of his job. And the way they did that was by Tom Marino and Marsha Blackburn launching an inspector general's investigation of him. Joe has a temper. Joe said some things on a phone call with committee staffers. The accounts differ. Joe said, all I said was that your law will protect defendants that we have under investigation. Others say he was a little stronger. But Marino and Blackburn launched an investigation of Joe for trying to intimidate the U.S. Congress. Once that was launched, his career was done. Holder left, and the new attorney general was Loretta Lynch, and the deputy was Sally Yates. A new head of the DEA came in, his name is Chuck Rosenberg, and he was under enormous pressure from Congress and the drug industry to bring this cooperative relationship back, to mend the rift that Ran Azizi had created by approaching the subject differently. And so there was a lot of pressure on the DEA to begin being cooperative again. So all of those things happened just before the law passed in early 2016, and they mattered. As for the unanimous consent, you know, Joe ticked off a lot of people in Congress. And so some people just didn't like Joe. And others relied on the fact that the DEA said this was okay. Why did the DEA say this was okay? This is the main matter of contention in our story. The DEA says, we finally knuckled under, we compromised, because if we didn't compromise with Hatch, we were going to get a worse deal. So we took the best deal we could take. Hatch's office says, nonsense. DEA supplied the language. DEA went along with this. There is no controversy. They agreed, and everybody passed it by unanimous consent, and the president signed it. We cannot reconcile those two competing versions of what went on, although we are still trying.
Partly because you're not getting the documentation, you're not getting the memos, the emails, et cetera, from DOJ, the DEA, et cetera.
I think we filed something like 17 Freedom of Information Act requests over the past 18 months, and most of them have either been denied or delayed. We are suing the Justice Department in federal court for some of this information.
You went to see Tom Marino in his office in Congress, and what happened?
We went in with the 60 Minutes crew, who was our collaborator throughout this entire story. And they said, you have to leave the office, you have to turn off the camera. That's fine. We went out into the hallway, and we were there for a few minutes, and they called the Capitol Police on us. And they said, you know, we heard you wouldn't leave the office. And the 60 Minutes correspondent said, that's not true. We did that as soon as they asked. And they said, well, you wouldn't turn off the camera. And he said, we did that. And basically, we hung out in the hallway, which is completely our right to do. It's completely everyone's right to do. And that was the end of it. But it was sort of remarkable that they called the police on us.
Well, that story had a big... Go ahead.
I apologize. There's one little thing here that we didn't mention that I want to make sure everybody listening to your podcast knows. Lyndon Barber helped write the Marino Law. It's not a secret in Washington that lobbyists write legislation. They do it all the time. But everybody should know that we have an email. Someone asks someone else, who is Lyndon Barber? And the person responds, Lyndon Barber works for the drug industry, used to be with DEA. He helped write the Marino Law. So at a time when all these opioid deaths were going on, Tom Marino was not above taking a law that was at least partially crafted by the industry itself.
And nevertheless, he became President Trump's nominee to head the Office of National Drug Control Policy,
correct,
the so-called drug czar.
Right.
Your story comes out, has a huge impact, and Marino withdraws his name. But not only that, I understand you've been up on Capitol Hill. Some of the members of Congress who supported the Marino Law, now having seen your reporting, having seen the 60 Minutes report, appear to be recognizing or realizing that maybe they went too far. What's happening now on Capitol Hill?
Right. I think this is where the rubber meets the road. Marino withdrawing, in retrospect, was inevitable because it would be very difficult for him to go to a town hall meeting in a place that has been ravaged by opioids and talk about drug control policy at this point. I don't see how that could have worked.
I know that Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, was furious after hearing your report. What kind of other reaction have you gotten from the opioid addiction areas?
Well, they are furious. They are furious. They feel this is hypocrisy. They feel that this is not acceptable when 60,000 Americans are going to die this year from opioid overdoses. And they think they've seen the swamp. They have seen the swamp that the president of the United States has promised to drain. And yet there it is on full display. The drug companies, the Congress, the influence peddling. That's what my emails are saying, is we saw the swamp. The folks that you have mentioned earlier who are now talking about repeal or amendment of the act, of the Ensuring Patient Access Act, are vehement about it. They're mostly Democrats, and they're saying we can't take this weapon away from the DEA. We have got to reverse that decision. But Senator Hatch is opposed, and he's very influential in the Senate. Senator Grassley, who heads the Judiciary Committee, said, you know, I'll hold an oversight hearing and see what's what, but I don't know that we're going to take any action. So to me, that's where the rubber meets the road is. Are they going to change that law? Are they going to give that authority back to the DEA? To me, that's the test of what we revealed here and how the Congress is going to respond.
Well, meanwhile, President Trump has called attention himself to the opioid crisis. He has promised on repeated occasion to declare the opioid crisis a national emergency. As you mentioned before, he owes his election in many ways to voters in some of the most heavily affected areas. So, you know, President Trump might yet have something to say about this.
It seems to me that almost nothing bad can come from declaring this an emergency. Even if there's not a lot of actual movement on the ground, more money, which I think there will be, more treatment, which I hope there will be, just throwing the spotlight on it from the White House is really important. But we need to see exactly what it is the president's going to do to know whether or not it will be effective.
What could he do? What could be some of the practical implications of him declaring an emergency in this case?
So as you know, emergencies are basically, the laws that govern emergencies are basically written for hurricanes and earthquakes and fires and natural disasters of sort of limited duration. Here we have an epidemic that has been proceeding basically for 15 years. So the laws aren't really applicable, but what they can do is cut through red tape and get things out faster. They can find ways to send more money. They can send U.S. public health personnel, I think there's 6,000 people in the public health service, into some of these communities. And maybe they can expand treatment. Maybe they can expand naloxone so that everybody's got naloxone in their cabinet that's an antidote to overdoses. Maybe they can start, watching more pharmacies and doctors. Maybe the DEA will get beefed up and they can do more enforcement. Anything at this point will be helpful.
It seems to me this is a good example of how many really potentially important laws are passed without much scrutiny, without much attention by the lawmakers themselves.
I'm a health reporter. I don't work on Capitol Hill. I asked that question 100 times. Why did this pass by UC, by unanimous consent? All it takes is one senator to stick something in the gears of the way the process works and hold it up and say, wait a minute, this is not the world's best idea. Why didn't that happen? And the best answer we got is, A, it happens a lot, and you guys just don't realize it because they're always non-controversial until something like this happens. And B, agencies make calculations all the time about how much political capital they want to spend. And so to bring a halt to this after 2 years of negotiation and shut it down might have been the right thing to do, and it might have given them what they wanted. There would have been a cost somewhere. There would have been a political cost somewhere for pushing back after all that work on this law that Congress clearly wanted passed.
Well, Lenny Bernstein, great work on your part and the rest of your Washington Post crew and the 60 Minutes crew as well. Congratulations.
Thank you so much for having me.
And now a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Joining me now is retired Army General Martin Dempsey, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He joins me from Duke University, where he is currently a Rubenstein Fellow and teaching several courses on leadership and civil-military relations. Well, General Dempsey, thanks so much for joining us.
Tom, it's great to be with you.
General Dempsey, I have to say I've known you for a while. We've met several times, but really what caught my attention most recently is your Twitter feed, at Martin_Dempsey, for the benefit of our listeners. Your your tweets recently, at least, consist of aphorisms about leadership. You really have mastered the art of Twitter and that 140-character limit of saying some really thoughtful things.
Well, thanks, Tom. The way that all evolved was almost 2 years ago now, I began to write a book with Ori Brafman, who's a professor out at Berkeley. The title of the book is Radical Inclusion, What the Post-9/11 World Should Have Taught Us About Leadership. And as we began to write the book, and this, I think this is a pretty common occurrence for authors, we actually began to learn things and see some connections that we hadn't known before, or hadn't seen before. And so I decided that I would both incorporate what we were learning in writing into the book, but even kind of more importantly, I would start this Twitter feed about leadership in order to share some of at least my beliefs about what makes an effective leader. And, it's not surprising I would take to Twitter because I have a master's degree in English literature, and I became fond of the sonnet as a form, as a genre of poetry. And, 14 lines of iambic pentameter with a rhyme couplet, and you can define love, you can define hate. And so, Twitter seems to me to be kind of the modern day, not that I consider myself a poet, but Twitter seems to me to be the modern day equivalent of sonnets, which used to be read quite widely among interested thinkers.
Well, that's pretty remarkable in and of itself that a 4-star general, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, actually graduated in English literature and sort of looks to poetry for inspiration.
On occasion.
Yeah. Well, let's go through some of these tweets that you have written, because they really can offer a script for this entire conversation. I'm going to read a few here. Great leaders share the spotlight. Effective leaders lower their volume so others can be heard. Ideas flow to where they are welcome. The most effective leaders, those who inspire their followers, compliment them in public and criticize them in private. A couple more. Great leaders make it clear that disagreement isn't considered disloyalty. And this one, great leaders are motivated by results, not reviews, accomplishments, not accolades, humility, not hubris. General Dempsey, it's impossible to read those tweets and not think about our current president. Did you have Donald Trump in mind when you tweeted some of those things? Because some of those principles stand in contrast actually to the way he talks and the way he has some of his attitudes.
I have been asked that question often, Tom, and no, I'm not a troll of President Trump's. All I can really do is explain what I've learned over the many decades of service in what makes a leader effective. And then, by the way, results count too. Leaders are selected in order to deliver something. I happen to believe they're selected to both deliver and to develop those beneath them to someday be all they can be, or to fulfill their potential. If others want to compare what I'm saying to any other leaders in our country, they're certainly welcome to do that, but that's not my intention.
Well, I'm sure you're not surprised that some people read those tweets and make that connection.
No, I'm not, because it's, this is how we communicate with each other these days, apparently. So on occasion, though, I will tweet something where I have personal knowledge, others may not, and I feel a need to share that personal knowledge, as I did in explaining the fact that the two presidents I served, President Bush and President Obama, both had the well-being of those serving the fallen and their families uppermost and foremost in their minds.
Yeah, that was a tweet you put out just this week after President Trump had implied that some of his predecessors had not been very diligent about calling the parents of fallen warriors. You tweeted POTUS 43 and 44, that would be George W. Bush and Barack Obama, and first ladies care deeply, work tirelessly for the serving, the fallen and their families, not politics, sacred trust.
Right.
Yeah. Let's go back to just last year. You made some news when Generals John Allen and Mike Flynn got involved in the presidential campaign. You sort of scolded them publicly, advising them not to become part of the public political landscape. Is that still your view, or do you feel any more obligation to speak out, on issues that, at least those issues of which you have personal knowledge?
Each service has its own culture, but there are certain things that we have in common, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine, and Coast Guard. Importantly, one of those is the fact that we remain nonpartisan in American politics, and it's important we do so that as elected officials change and presidents come and go, they can have the confidence that their military will, support them in the direction they choose for our national security, so long as something isn't illegal or immoral. Those that have become admirals and generals are admirals and generals for life. I mean, you introduced me in this segment as General Dempsey, even though I've been retired for 2 years. So I'm well aware that I will be General Dempsey for the rest of my life. And I'm proud of that, by the way. But it also comes with a certain responsibility to continue to help, let's say, advocate that which makes us a profession. And one of the things that defines us as a profession is the fact that we're nonpartisan, so that our elected officials can always trust that our advice is given with the best interests of the country in mind, regardless of our personal politics.
Of course, we now have a president who has surrounded himself with three strong generals, one active duty, Lieutenant General McMaster at the NSC, plus Generals Mattis at Defense and General Kelly as Chief of Staff at the White House. As military officers, do you think they have some kind of unique moderating or positive influence on the president, maybe perhaps with the effect of getting him to be a more effective leader?
Well, I don't know what kind of relationship they have with him, but what I do know is the quality of those three men. But look, I'll be honest with you. Although I have great confidence in their abilities, it's a bit of an aberration in our system to have that much military presence so close to the President of the United States. I mean, the one who's actually charged with providing military advice is the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, currently General Joe Dunford. Here's what I worry about. What appears to be happening to me is that you've got these three very capable individuals there, but they are known to be generals, and the president himself refers to them as my generals. And eventually, you know, they will be the ones that are held accountable either for holding him back and making sure we don't go off a precipice, or failing to support him so he can achieve his agenda, which means that in future administrations, there will be suspicions about the role of the military. And I find that to be, I'm not comfortable with that, but that's where we are.
I imagine that this period will be, I mean, you're teaching civil-military relations. I imagine this period will be seen as a kind of a case study in civil-military relations for the very reasons you just outlined.
Yeah, it probably guaranteed my employment in academia for the next 25 years.
Yeah. So let's talk about the the book that you have coming out. You mentioned it at the top of this segment. You title it Radical Inclusion. Tell us about that title. I assume that this sort of reflects your personal leadership philosophy.
It refers both to my personal leadership philosophy, but also to what I believe, and I should say we now, because Uri Braffman and I have been studying this for about the last 10 years, learning about what's new in the environment in which we have to lead. And one of the things that's new, and it won't surprise you, Tom, is the kind of ubiquitous presence of information, the speed at which information flows, the accessibility, where everyone, everywhere, all the time has access to information. And what that does is it increases scrutiny. It allows for a battle of narratives. John Adams, our second president, said, facts are stubborn things. And his point was the facts will come out. I just don't find facts to be all that stubborn these days. In fact, in many ways, one could make the case, as we do, that facts are vulnerable. And in that environment, trust is what is held in the balance. You know, it's much more difficult now to generate trust as a leader. And if you don't get in that arena and fight for the trust and confidence of all who follow you, someone else will. And I use the example of memes, you know, that memes are these things that pass from individual to individual rather than from institutions to individuals. So Chewbacca Mom is an entertainment meme. It'll warm your heart as she drives her children to school in the Chewbacca mask. Or the Ice Bucket Challenge, where, you know, men and women raised hundreds of millions of dollars for to fight ALS. A wonderful use of technology. But ISIS is also a meme. It started as a group, with an isolated group. It became a movement when other groups franchised themselves with it. And now it's the ideology spreads from individual to individual. And so we have to just recognize that in that environment, it takes a different kind of leadership, a more attentive leadership, a more inclusive leadership.
Well, inclusive seems to me to be a really key part of that philosophy. And of course, the U.S. military is one of the most inclusive institutions in America, isn't it?
Well, we're proud of that. Yeah, we absolutely, all of our leaders have said, at least as long as I can remember, that if you're interested in serving your country and you can meet the standards, whoever you are, wherever you came from, whatever your religious beliefs, whatever your lifestyle is, if you can meet the standards, we've got a place for you in trying to defend our country.
So speaking of trust, you had an op-ed a year ago on the issue of whether athletes should stand for the national anthem or not. And of course, now that has become a huge controversy. Remind us what you said about that a year ago and how you have updated that today.
The shortest version of this is that I've said that individuals can kneel but should stand. And I explained that the national anthem, when I was a younger man, I remember it was played frequently, as was the Pledge of Allegiance. And so it was a routine part of my life. I think it's fair to say that the national anthem has kind of beat a slow retreat into our stadiums and our arenas. And so my appeal to the athletes was to understand that, we've got 90 seconds or so is the duration of the national anthem, and it's very infrequently experienced anymore. And for those 90 seconds, it feels to me as though we should focus on what brings us together, knowing that the rest of the day, the rest of the week, the rest of the month, the rest of the year, when you're not listening to the national anthem, there's plenty of opportunities to dispute or to find things that pull us apart. You ask how my thoughts may have changed over the course of the last year, and I don't think they have changed very much. What's happened over the last year is, of course, the baseline argument about the nature of protest, what was being protested, I think, has shifted a bit. I'm not even sure most people remember what Colin Kaepernick's original protest happens to be about. And so, that's because the noise level has been turned up. And now I think we're talking at each other, not to each other.
Let's talk about some other specific issues that you have discussed in your tweets. The one that I especially liked was on bureaucracy. Of course, that's become a dirty word in some quarters. You tweeted this. I don't remember how long ago this was. You say bureaucracies are a safety net. They exist to ensure things don't go badly wrong. Solid, pragmatic, inclusive ideas get through. Now, that's a real novel thought.
Learned the hard way. I mean, I came to Washington in 2011 or so to become the chief staff of the Army. And, I had come out of the field where Washington, appeared to be the root of most of the evil in my life, trying to get things done. But what happens is you pretty quickly learn that processes are generally put in place because they provide order, and bureaucracy is in place, as I said, as a safety net. Now, bureaucracy and processes, how you walk into a meeting room and you know where you're going to sit and what particular part of the argument is yours to present. The leader's responsibility is to hear all of those different parts of the argument and then come to some conclusion about it. But without some structure, without that structure, I've found that the organization can tend to drift. And so, there was this kind of groundswell of applauding people for blowing through bureaucracy and process. And I felt at the time I tweeted that maybe someone should speak. Very few people speak on behalf of bureaucracy because you can be seen as being, you know, slow on the mark or something. And I wanted to make sure everyone knew that bureaucracy is not a pejorative term unless it results in paralysis. And that's a different problem.
Here's another one from this week, General Dempsey. Time for steady. Puerto Rico, wildfires, budget, anthem, Iran, North Korea, cybersecurity, solvable with leadership. Let's just take the big one there, North Korea.
Yeah.
I think you said back in August, any war with Pyongyang would include probably the worst kind of fighting in most people's lifetime. What do you want to tell people these days as we seem to be inching closer to the actual prospect of some kind of military confrontation there? What do you think it's important to say right now?
It was always my impression that in dealing with these issues individually, we lose focus on the fact that they're somehow all related, and that as the most powerful nation in the world, the status quo power, the power with global reach and global responsibility, that we really need to remember that all of these issues have to be dealt with as a coherent whole. And when you cherry pick them and overly simplify them, you run the risk of making bad decisions. But you ask about North Korea. So let me live up to what I just said. We really shouldn't just think of North Korea as some isolated issue with which we have to deal. It impacts our relationship with Russia and China. It's impacting our relationship with our allies. We have five allies in the Pacific region. We really should take a look at what it means to the future of Iran. And what I mean by that is, you know, there is the potential that we would have to deal with two rogue nations with nuclear weapons. You know, with rogue nations, you really want to control the clock. And so you slow the clock down. You make sure you're bringing your allies along with you. You understand what your actions are going, how they're going to impact the other two superpowers of the world, Russia and China. And in so doing, you commit fewer mistakes. And as you go along, doesn't mean you're inactive, but as you go along, you know, you look for both opportunities and vulnerabilities. But to be precipitous, I think, is problematic.
You know, it sometimes seems like our current president thinks it's a good idea to keep the North Koreans, for example, guessing about our intentions, or other adversaries for that matter as well, you know, what the U.S. might actually do. But to quote another of your tweets, great leaders use ambiguity but avoid unpredictability. What's the difference?
There's a significant difference. And again, that wasn't aimed at the president in any way. But, you know, when you ask a president of the United States, what's more important? You know, the fact that we counter Russian aggressiveness in Eastern Europe, or we ensure that that we manage the peaceful rise of China, or we lower the debt, or we, you know, repeal and replace Obamacare, or we continue to put pressure on ISIS, they are not going to put those in order for you. And in fact, in many cases, senior leaders want to be a little more coy, a little more ambiguous about their priorities. And if I knew that I was only the 10th priority for the United States, I might act out because I think I can get away with it because they're consumed with priorities 1 through 9. So you're always going to see some ambiguity. But unpredictability is not helpful in the workplace. It's not helpful in government, where allies in particular, you know, our entire national security architecture is built around 53 allies and partners around the globe. And if they don't understand what we're trying to accomplish, how committed we are to those alliances, what we intend our role to be in the global economy and in the global national security structure or the security structure, then we create doubt, and I think those kind of doubts are not helpful. So ambiguity, everybody understands ambiguity. Nobody expects perfect clarity on priorities, but people do not understand unpredictability.
One more hot topic I want to ask you about, General Dempsey, one that's been in the news a lot just in the last couple of weeks, and that is the The problem of sexual assault is all of a sudden in the aftermath of the Harvey Weinstein controversy. It's getting a lot of attention.
On the issue of sexual assault, first things first, sexual assault is a crime. And so we have to eliminate crime from our ranks. The precursor, sexual harassment, is what leads to an environment that allows that crime to occur in the first place. And we've tried over the course of time, the group of chiefs, joint chiefs that I had the privilege to work with, you know, we worked the issue. I think we moved the issue in a positive direction a bit. I don't think we moved it nearly as far as we had hoped. It takes, you know, constant reinforcement and constant vigilance. But it really does start with the environment that a commander establishes in terms of equality and equal opportunity for all men and women, regardless of, I said that already, regardless of their gender. And the reason it's so important, setting aside for a second the fact that it's a crime and we're all, we all have the obligation to uphold the law, it also, in the military's case, it erodes the very thing that holds us together, which is trust, you know? I tell people, you don't walk out of a forward operating base in Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever you're stationed, unless you have complete trust that the individual to your left or right, whether it's a man or a woman or the medic or the helicopter pilot, unless you have complete trust that they both know what they're doing but are committed to you as an individual and to the organization as a team.
But are there ever any cases where a military commander may be reluctant to destroy the career of some highly valued military officer who may have gone over the line? Are there, are there situations like that?
You know, I've actually been accused of that myself on occasion. You know, when you hold command positions, you're going to be questioned on how you make decisions. Let me put it this way, Tom. I'm sure there are. I mean, I just haven't ever experienced a case where just because someone, just because you went to war with somebody because they achieved a certain rank, have performed well. I've never seen anybody say, we need this guy. This guy needs to get a pass because of past service. What I have seen, though, is this decisions made where the legal system, there may be plenty of evidence, circumstantial evidence that something occurred. But let's say only a portion of it can actually be proved. And look, even though we have a responsibility to make the organization a safer place for men and women to serve, we also have an obligation to make sure that the individual rights, those guaranteed, by our Constitution for every individual, are protected.
So, as you said, you're the child of four Irish grandparents, and I've had the pleasure of hearing you sing Irish folk songs on many occasions. I was tempted to ask you to sing for us today, but I'm gonna resist that because we're running out of time. I do wonder if there's a little stanza of an Irish poem that you sort of carry around in your head that kind of sums up, your life philosophy or some lesson.
Well, there are many. Thank you for not asking me to sing because I would have had to deny the request and probably felt badly about that for the rest of the day. But there is something I've always carried around from Yeats. It's a single phrase. And he wrote it at the time in European history when, the Irish were in rebellion after 1916. World War I was raging. It was beginning to be evident that even in the resolution of World War I, some of the seeds were being planted for what would later become another world war in the European continent. He was very perceptive. And he said this. He said, "Talent perceives differences, genius unity." And I've always carried that around because I find it to be extraordinary in its applicability over time. And I would suggest, that today we've got plenty of folks pointing out how we're different. And I think far few that are trying to illuminate for us and amplify for us the way we are similar, and I think we need more of that.
Absolutely. So that's retired Army General Martin Dempsey, who served two terms as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the top officer in the U.S. military. He's now teaching at Duke, and he's the author of an upcoming book on leadership titled Radical Inclusion, What the Post-9/11 World Should Have Taught Us About Leadership, co-authored with Ori Brofman. He tweets at Martin_Dempsey. General Dempsey, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Tom.
And that's it for this week. Diane will be back next week. We'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851. You can also go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden and comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Sandra Baker, Rebecca Kaufman, and Ellison Brody. Thanks for listening. This is Tom Gelton of NPR.